What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Well, I think the issue is Zionism and the neocons. Zionism exists in the United States and exists in Israel. You know, Christian Zionists, the majority of Zionists are Christian, not Jews. And you see the U.S. ambassador being one of the most crazy and fanatical of them all. You saw his letter to Trump.
Mike Huckabee, yeah.
Trump posted that letter. And then they call us Iranians the crazy fanatics. It's quite stunning. You know, you look at this letter, and if any Iranian politician had ever posted such a thing, people would call that person in Iran. Anyway, so you I think it's Zionism. Now the contradiction, Christian Zionists are telling us that Christ supports genocide. So that's the exact opposite of what we believe about Christ. Christians in our part of the world believe about Christ, and Christians across the world believe about Christ. But that's what these people are claiming. And of course, Christian Zionists and Jewish Zionists, their relations, they're very close, but what Christian Zionists say will happen to Jewish Zionists at the end of time is not really very nice. But the point is that it is Zionism. And so Zionism exists both in the United States and in occupied Palestine. And therefore, I think you can't really say it's this side that's in charge or that side. It's something that's in both entities.
Speaking of Trump and speaking of Zionism and these negotiations, I wanted to ask you to respond to something that White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said recently in response to questions on Iran's nuclear weapons. Let me just play this. Okay, let's take a look. Oh, actually, before that, let me read, because you mentioned this, let me read this. Brad, can I add this? I want to read the letter that the professor brought up. Okay, great. Is it like way too small? Well, all right, I'll just read it in the other thing. You guys can see it. You know what? Let's bring back the professor. I'll read the letter. It's not really worth seeing it because it's so small, but I'll read what it says. Mr. President, God spared you in Butler, PA, to be the most consequential president in a century, maybe ever. The decisions on your shoulders, I would not want to be made by anyone else. You have many voices speaking to you, sir, but there is only one, all caps, voice that matters. His, all caps, voice. I am your appointed servant in this land, and I'm available for you, but I do not try to get in your presence often because I trust your instincts. No president in my lifetime has been in a position like yours, not since Truman in 1945. I don't reach out to persuade you, only to encourage you. I believe you will hear from heaven, and that voice is far more important than mine or anyone else's. You sent me to Israel to be your eyes, ears, and voice, and to make sure our flag flies above our embassy. My job is to be the last one to leave. I will not abandon this post. Our flag will not come down. You did not seek this moment. This moment sought you. It is my honor to serve you, Mike Huckabee. And that is something that Trump posted on Truth Social. And he said, from Mike Huckabee, a pastor, politician, ambassador, and great person. He also happened to write a book about weight loss called like Quit Digging Your Grave with Your Own Fork and Knife or something, but that's another issue. So what are your thoughts on this this evangelical letter?
Well, if this was something that was, I mean, the whole, one of the key arguments about Iran is that it is a fanatical regime, that they're extremists, that they're irrational, that they believe everyone else is evil and that they're good. But that's exactly, just like you were saying, it's a mirror of their own qualities and characteristics. They see everyone as uncivilized. They see everyone as inferior. Just recently, we had a number of friends that you either know or you know of or you've been in communication with travel to Iran. And they, I think, experienced, despite the sanctions, despite the difficulties that exist in Iran, they experienced a normal society where people are living their lives, people walk around the streets, shopping, working, enjoying themselves, struggling to find jobs. It's just like any other society. But what we're and we're being presented as a fanatical society that is out to kill people. We're out to kill Jews, we're told. But we have Jewish MP in our parliament, our constitution, the post-revolution constitution has said that the Jewish community in Iran has to have an MP. It's in the constitution. If there's one Jew in Iran, one Jew, that Jew will be an MP. Because according to the constitution, the Jewish community in Iran has to have an MP in parliament.
I should move to Iran then. I should kick out the other ones. And I mean, I'm just saying I have a high chance. If I want to be an MP, that's probably where I'd have to move.
To help me at the university. Either way, something that I said earlier, I also have to stress, point out, and that is that in Iran, not only do we have Jewish MPs, Christian MPs, Zoroastrian MPs in constitution, but also contrary to what we hear in the West, in Iran we have very severe debates. We have debates online, offline, about the nuclear program, about the government, about the leadership, about the leader, about the direction that the government takes. But in the West, when you have these, when they look at Iran, they say, first of all, they say Iran is, they say it's an authoritarian regime and people are not allowed to speak. But also simultaneously, you hear that there are deep divisions in Iran and that the regime is unstable. But deep divisions in the West means debate and democracy, and different sides have differing opinions, and that's healthy. But in Iran, if you have different people having different debates, that's a sign of instability in the regime. So the same thing that exists in Iran, if it exists in the West, it's portrayed as something positive. But in the case of Iran, it's a sign of its instability and the fact that this is the nature of a regime. Or, for example, it's on the one hand authoritarian, but there are deep divisions and people hate the regime. That if it's authoritarian, then people are not going to express their hatred for the so-called regime. So there's so many subtle discrepancies in the narrative, but since it's negative, and so many people are used to seeing Iran as a country, even though they don't really fit with each other, people generally accept them because it's bad, so it must make sense. And for example, they'll say that Iran is falling apart. It's corrupt. People hate it. The regime is evil. It's imploding. Okay. Then you hear it's a rising threat to humanity. It's a growing menace. It's a threat to the region. It's a growing threat to the world. How can it be falling apart and imploding and at the same time be a rising threat that is about to undermine the whole region? Can't be both, but the narrative includes both at the same time.
Right. It kind of reminds me of the way that with the Iraq War, and this is such a repeat of that. For my younger viewers, we'll talk about this either later in this show or another episode, but this is a major repeat. But it reminds me of the way that people were so convinced that Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein were working together because they're so ignorant about it. Like, if they knew about it, people would know it doesn't make sense that these people would be collaborating. But it was just, you just hear it again and again. You know, it's like what Goebbels says, if you repeat a lie enough, people start believing it.
And, you know, the interesting thing about Al-Qaeda is that you use Al-Qaeda as one of the excuses to invade Iraq. It was false. They also used chemical weapons, which was false. They gave Saddam Hussein chemical weapons to use against Iranians and his own people. And then later on, when he gave them up under sanctions after Kuwait, they still invaded him, even though they knew he had no chemical weapons. They gave it to him. They took it away from him. They took them away from him, and then they invaded and destroyed the country. But Al-Qaeda, or Al-Qaeda, they said that he worked with them. The United States was working with Al-Qaeda, The United States helped create Al-Qaeda. In fact, Jimmy Carter and Brzezinski, they were the ones who decided to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in order to encourage the Soviet Union to invade the country. It wasn't a response to the Soviet occupation. It was done to encourage the occupation. So what Carter and Brzezinski did was that they sacrificed Afghanistan to create a Vietnam for Russia. They sacrificed the lives of millions of people in order to make life difficult for the Soviet Union. And then the United States itself, back then, of course, they had the Saudis and the Emiratis in particular helping them out. But the Emiratis and the Saudis didn't have the facilities back then. So the United States published the first textbooks, school textbooks, of fanaticism. These Takfiri textbooks that were designed to make school children hate Russians were published in the United States at Nebraska Omaha University. I think your viewers could, and your listeners can, use DeepSeek or whatever to look that up right now. So the United States published the first books for these extremists. They created Al-Qaeda. And then they invaded Iraq for cooperating with Al-Qaeda. And then you'd imagine that after 9/11, the United States would give up Al-Qaeda for good, because according to the official narrative, it was all done by Al-Qaeda, and that was it. And whether that's true or not, that's a different story. Or whether it's more complicated than that, it's different. That's, debatable. I personally think it wasn't just Al-Qaeda. I think that there were elements in the United States, the intelligence. I don't know how deep it goes, but I think it goes more in the Israeli regime that had something to do with it. But anyway. But then the United States began to work with Al-Qaeda a decade after 9/11, they overthrew the Libyan government and sodomized the leader of Libya. And Hillary Clinton gloated and said, "We came, we saw, he died." And then they used Al-Qaeda with the help of Turkey and Jordan and the oil and gas-rich countries in the Persian Gulf, and of course the Israelis, to overthrow the Syrian government, which they succeeded months ago. So that's the Al-Qaeda that was used as an excuse to invade Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for mentioning that. It is so disgusting. I mentioned earlier the rape narrative that was used. It is so repulsive that Hillary Clinton made a joke about someone dying who was, as you pointed out, sodomized to death, like with a bayonet. This is something that, in theory, the West, with our enlightened values, spreading democracy, would be horrified by. But not only were we not horrified by it, the Western government, Hillary Clinton, it was something to celebrate and even laugh about. Which is, if that had been reversed and someone, let's say an Iranian official or a Palestinian official, had done that, they would have been portrayed as monsters, subhuman.
And even Hillary Clinton's opponents, or Trump's opponents, that's not something that they'll attack them for. because the other is so horrible. Again, it's like Iran. Like the mainstream liberals, they oppose, they hate Trump. Anything that he does is horrible. If you recall, in 2016, he was a Russian agent, Russiagate. But as soon as he began firing missiles at Syria, he became the president.
Exactly. Van Jones said that.
Yes, exactly.
That was disgusting. That was really repulsive.
So when it comes to the other, you know, Trump is fine.
By the way, I know it's extremely late for you. I want to be respectful of your time. How much time do you have left in you, like, to go? Because well, I know it's really late. So let me know.
I'm hearing myself the whole time. All right. It's long.
12 more
that's
hours.
The only problem.
Yeah. Okay. How about 20 minutes? Is that good?
Sure, whatever you like.
Okay, great. Because again, it is very late. Do you not sleep a lot, by the way?
Well, these days are a bit different. So I'm not. The universities, right now is exam time. They've delayed exams because of the war that's been imposed upon us. And I've been trying to do as much media as possible because I feel it's my responsibility to do so.
Have people encouraged you to leave for your own safety?
Yes, a lot of people.
And what is going through your mind when you...
They've encouraged me to stop doing interviews and to get rid of my cell phone.
Right. So what makes you decide I'm going to stay here and I'm going to continue doing interviews? I mean, obviously with the Katie Halper show, I mean, major opportunity. You can't say no to that.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt.
But what makes you stay home and stay there?
Well, I've watched your show before many times. So
oh, thank you.
I'm a big fan.
Thanks.
It's a big opportunity for me. Why not? But I think lots of people think the same way I do. I'm sure that you and others would do the same. You don't have to do this. You can do something else. I'm sure you have lots of antagonists because of the things that you say and the work that you do.
Yeah, but I'm not brave. I wouldn't stay. I mean, just to be honest, I'm not saying this to, like, you know, blow smoke up anything, but like I don't have the bravery to stay somewhere. I would probably go. I'm not encouraging you at all. I mean, I'm just kind of blown away. I mean, a similar thing when Susan Abu Hawa went to Gaza, or when you have other doctors who stay in Gaza. That doctor whose name is escaping me, but who's still in prison, who is married to a woman, I believe from Tajikistan, he could have left and he stayed. I just can't get over the bravery of people who either are there, like, so you're already there, but you could leave, or the people who go there. What is it that, and all the bravery you see of the Palestinians who won't leave either. What is going through your mind? Like, how do you keep on keeping on?
Well, to be very blunt, and I don't feel that my life is in danger.
Okay.
I've been asked by people from security. They've approached me and said, look, it's best if you don't have your cell phone because you're speaking and defending Iran. And they can track you with your cell phone, and, you know, that could be trouble. But I told them that, look, if I give up my cell phone, then I can't do interviews, I can't say anything, so I'm not going to do that. And they said, okay, you know, be careful. So this is my cell phone I'm using right now. And for example, when is very bad, I have to use a government building to speak at, because the ordinary communication is terrible right now. So right now in Tehran, we can only use internal websites. So I have to be in a government building like Press TV or somewhere else to be able to have a better connection to speak to people. So people do tell me stop doing interviews. But I personally am not, I don't feel like I'm a target. I have no idea. But in any case, it's what I think I have to do. It's my responsibility. And I think you and others would do the same if you were in my situation. So I'm not doing anything exceptionally brave. And there are many people in Tehran right now. They've asked me to not use my cell phone, but there are many people in Tehran right now in the city. Before the show began, there were 3 explosions. People are in the city. Maybe some people died as a result. I don't know. I'll have to check later or check the news. But, you know, a lot of Iranians are most overwhelmingly, the Iranians are steadfast. And I'm just one ordinary Iranian. I just happen to speak in English.
Well, speaking of which, can I ask you about your background? You were born in the United States. So what is your was your trajectory?
Well, my parents moved to the United States to study, but also my father was, he'd been in prison once for his political views, and then he was about to be arrested again. So my parents left the United States. I was born in Richmond, Virginia, and for 6 years, my parents moved to Ohio. And when the revolution happened, we moved back to Iran. And so I've lived in Iran ever since then, except for 3 years, 3 months, maybe 3 months in the UK for my PhD. Back then, there was no PhD program in English literature in Iran. Now there is. We have excellent students, and some of those students who graduated and are professors now are much better than me. My own colleagues in my department, young professors who graduated from the University of Tehran. You know, I tell my students, go have them as your supervisors, not me, they're way better. But back then, so I went to the UK for 3 years, and I spent 1 year in Lebanon, 1 year and 3 months for my sabbatical. Other than that, I've lived in Iran all this time.
So you speak English? Farsi, do you speak Arabic?
I do not speak Arabic well. If I'm alone in a taxi with a taxi driver, I'll practice. But if I'm in front of people, I'll be too shy to make the horrible mistakes that I know.
Got it, yeah.
But my mother tongue would be Persian.
Right, right. I just didn't know because you were in Lebanon. I didn't know if you... worked on that or...
Yeah, I learned a bit of Arabic, but the problem with Lebanon is that so many people speak in English that as soon as you try practicing your Lebanon and they see how horrible you are, they start speaking with you in English.
Well, back to... Oh, and what was your father's, if I may ask, what got him in trouble? Like, why... What got him... What landed him in prison?
He imposed the Shah, and he was a supporter of Imam Khomeini. And before that, his family supported the Mossadegh government. And then, of course, they opposed the coup and all that. So they were not happy with the situation. And he spent 6 months in prison, about 3 years before I was born, I think. Yeah, something like that. Years before that, and he was about to be arrested again for statements that he had made that were against the Shah when he left for the United States.
Back to the question I had started to ask you before we got distracted.
There was another explosion, by the way. I don't know if it's anti-aircraft fire or surface-to-air missile, but yeah, so that your viewers know. I'm sure you couldn't hear it because it was the
problem. No, yeah, we couldn't hear it, yeah. I get so... I do have, like, a lot of... I remember when we interviewed Rifat Alarir, and he, you know, while we were interviewing him, we could hear that. That is a very, you
I
know...
I think I actually watched that.
Yeah.
And I think there was an explosion while he was speaking, right?
Yeah. There were, it happened a bunch of times though, because it also happened when he was on Electronic Intifada. But I just remember him telling me, I asked him about his kids, and I remember him saying that they're kind of checked out, which is like a very painful thing to imagine and totally understandable, but it must be so hard to be a dad or just be an adult who, you know, and see what this is doing to children. So back to the question I started to ask you, there is a Caroline.
Yeah, I mean, like one scene that. Yeah, forget. I don't want to go. Yes.
No. Please.
Yeah, like when there was a loud explosion, and then someone, some UC person, fall to the ground. An explosion, not, at a somewhat distance, but very loud, and then you see, like, people completely terrified, and they can't move, and they sort of sit down, and they can't walk around.
Yeah. The media is so, makes it so hard to imagine what's happening. Like, we just think, the way they present it, it's like these evil doctors, evil scientists who are doing things. They want to destroy humanity. I mean, Netanyahu the other day on one of the Sunday morning news shows is like, what do? You let the scientists stay? And he realized, I think, that it wasn't a good look to, like, say out loud that they're killing scientists. So then he said, would you let Hitler scientists stay? And of course, the irony is, like, if you're the U.S., you let them stay alive and you actually hire them. You bring them here and you hire them.
Yeah, but,
exactly. Yeah, with Operation Paperclip. But people have no sense of the civilian count. They have no sense of, like, they don't see the people in Iran as people, really. There's, like, the way that the Israelis are presented, you have a face, you have a story, they're calling it a war crime today that there was a hospital that was attacked, like, not attacked. There was an explosion that hit a hospital. No one died. And Israel's calling it a war crime. And they've bombed 36 hospitals. So have they committed 36 war crimes?
Not only that, they bombed a hospital in Iran 2-3 days ago. But that's not something you'll hear in the Western media.
Right.
Then yesterday, they bombed the... what do you call it? The Red Crescent building in Tehran. And they killed, I think, two or three people. They bombed an ambulance, killing three medics. But none of this will be, you hear about it in the Western media, because Iranians are lesser people, just like Palestinians. I mean, when I was in Lebanon, I'm sorry, some of your viewers, I mean, I've been on quite a few shows, and I'm sure what I say is just repetitive and people are getting sick and tired of it. But when I was in Lebanon, I went to Lebanon as soon as the war began.
Which year are you talking about?
When the Israelis began bombing Lebanon months ago.
Okay, I didn't know if you meant 82 or not. Okay.
So I went to Beirut, and I went to Asaha Hotel, which is in southern Beirut. And the next day, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was martyred. But the point is that after they started bombing Beirut, people left the city, and they were all refugees in southern Beirut and other cities too. And then I was also a refugee. The hotel shut down. Someone took me in to his home in another part of Beirut. And then I began to do interviews, just like, ordinary interviews with, Sky News or or whatever, and also on programs like yourself, on your own program, RT. And I was in Beirut, and before I was supposed to go on Al Jazeera. And when Al Jazeera, the reporter that they sent to Beirut, speaking, she started insulting Iran. So they were bombing Beirut, Israelis, and she was busy attacking Iran, saying how Iran is evil and how Iran is violating women's rights and human rights. And then I was next, and I was saying, why is she speaking about Iran? They're attacking Beirut. They're killing the Lebanese. And but that's Al Jazeera. That's how hostile it is towards Iran. But the Western agencies were worse. Their reporters would constantly say, Israel is bombing these strongholds, Hezbollah strongholds, Hezbollah bases. And these reporters, Western reporters who were based in Beirut, they knew they were lying. Because they had drivers, they had fixers, they had producers, they had people who lived in these neighborhoods. They knew that the Israelis were just bringing down apartment blocks. But that's not the narrative, because they have to speak in a way which justifies these genocidal attacks. Just like in Gaza, At the beginning, when they struck the first hospital, if you recall, the world was outraged, and then they started trying to blame the resistance. And they said it was a rocket, like some small rocket would kill all these people. And then Western intelligence agencies even said, yes, our assessment is that thing. So they were all trying to blame the Palestinians. And then it was the second hospital. And they said there were tunnels there. And then the third, the fourth, the fifth, sixth. And then they started, you know.
And first it was that Israel would never do that, right? That was like the first response is Israel doesn't bomb hospitals. And then 30-something hospitals
later. Exactly. And not only would they do it, they unplug the incubators and kill the babies.
Yeah, I mean, it's like beyond, which is ironic because
that's what the Israelis would do.
Right. And the irony, of course, is that there was that myth about Saddam Hussein removing babies from incubators. That was, you know, to manufacture consent. They had that atrocity propaganda in Kuwait. Right. Didn't happen. But when something comparable does happen, it's ignored. When it doesn't happen, it's created as a lot. Yeah,
exactly. They use that. They use that lie about Saddam Hussein to justify the war. It was a lie.
Right. And
it was the daughter of the
Kuwaiti ambassador.
Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States who said those lies, and she wasn't even there.
Right.
But in Gaza, when they actually did this,
exactly,
not really important.
Right, right.
And by the way, one of the things that they kept saying about Gaza was that these people use civilians as shields.
Yeah, human shields, yeah.
The Israelis are deploying all their anti-missile systems right in the middle of residential neighborhoods.
Yeah.
In different cities. But they don't. The Western journalists don't say they're embedded in the civilian population.
Right.
That's only for Gaza.
And they use physical Palestinians as human shields. That's the other thing. Like there are photos of that happening.
Exactly.
Wanted to get you to respond to this because I keep saying we're going to show it. So now I feel like I really have to. Not. It may be a little anticlimactic, but this Caroline Leavitt clip. So let me just play this, and of course this is the. One of Trump's, many idiotic people working for him. Okay, here we go. Okay, great. All right, so here she is.
When the president says Iran is very close to a nuclear weapon, is he relying on U.S. intelligence or intelligence sharing from an ally to make that assessment?
It is a fact, and the United States government maintains this fact, that Iran has never been closer to obtaining a nuclear weapon.
I mean, how many times have we heard that? But what is your response to this claim?
Well, you know, let's say I've never been to New York, and I've like this is the closest I've ever been to New York, right? And I'm thousands of kilometers. I have been to New York, but I'm just saying. Let's say I've never been to New York, and this is the closest I've been here in Tehran. You can say. He's very close to New York. He's never been so close to New York before. What does that mean?
Right.
Does that mean that Iran is on the verge of developing a nuclear weapon? Iran is also the closest that it's ever been to sending a man on the moon. But is Iran on the verge of sending a man to the moon? Of course not. This is, of course, nonsense. And I'm sure if you, in your thinking about, the recent interview or the statement that Trump made in response to a reporter who said Tulsi Gabbard just recently said Iran is not developing a nuclear weapon. And he said, I don't care what she said. Iran is very close. It's obvious. This is just manufactured consent. And we saw that in the Iraq war, remember in the UN Security Council, the anthrax and all those lies. Which Colin Powell, to the end of his days, you know, regretted, and he helped. Someone who knows him well speaks of him. I'm not going to speak about him in particular, but in any case, he regretted that role that he played in this war. So these are lies, and let me just very quickly go over a couple of things that may be useful to your viewers. One is that, of course, you've heard Netanyahu has been saying since 1990. I looked this up on DeepSeek, but the first time that Netanyahu claimed that Iran is building nuclear weapons or is close to nuclear weapons is 1992. And he said it's 3 to 5 years away. And then 1993, 4, 6, 8, and so on, he's been saying the same thing since. Sometimes he says Iran is months away. Sometimes I think once he said it's weeks away. And then sometimes he says it's a couple of years away from a nuclear weapon. So that's Netanyahu, the serial liar. But some may say to you that okay, well, yes, he's a serial liar. Why did the International Atomic Energy Agency issue a statement against Iran just a while back? Now, regardless of the fact that the head of the agency just a couple of days ago admitted Iran is now producing a nuclear weapon, but the head of this body, this board of governors, is a political body. It's not a technical body.
Brad, what was the last thing I said that the professor said? Iran is...
I believe you were talking about the nuclear inspection agencies.
The International Atomic Energy. Yes, their board of governors is dominated by the West, just like all international institutions that were created post the Second World War. The OPCW, for example, for chemical weapons, dominated by the West. And when you've heard Alan McKay, I'm sure, explain this, that when they went to Syria, they said there's no evidence that the Syrian government carried the technical experts from the agency. They said that the evidence does not show that this was the Syrian government. And then what did they do? They sidelined the experts, and then they brought in their political people, their facts, to write a report against the Syrian government. Why? Because the OPCW is controlled by the West. The IAEA has a board of 35 members. 17 of them are European and North American. So already they have about half. Then Japan and Korea are also on the board. They have the majority. And they all, then with Argentina, which is the guy with the chainsaw, that's 20 countries out of 35. These 20 countries voted against Iran. So the West voted against Iran. China, India, they either voted against it or they didn't vote with the West. So the global South, which is the absolute majority by far, they did not vote for this resolution. So people who hear that the International Atomic Energy Agency voted against Iran say, wow, so the international community is against Iran. No, the West is against Iran. But the technical experts in the body have never shown any evidence whatsoever now in the past that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon. So that aside, there's a second question. And that is that, well, why is Iran producing enriched uranium at 60%? Iran doesn't need enriched uranium at 60%. It needs it at 20% for cancer patients. It needs it at over 3% for nuclear power plants. So why 60%? Obviously, they're building a bomb. No, I said this repeatedly during the nuclear negotiations that took place 3 years ago when I was their media, advisor.
I was an advisor. Okay.
Iran enriches uranium at 60% for leverage. Very clear, very obvious. They've said it. The West knows it. But they pretend this is not the truth. Why do they want leverage? Because if they don't have leverage, do you think that the West is ever going to remove sanctions against women and children? Look at Cuba. The United States is strangling Cuba to death. They don't have electricity right now. People there are walk to work because there's no gasoline. And this is a threat to the United States, Cuba. You know, as I said, they have removed all the sanctions from Al-Qaeda and ISIS, led Syria, but they won't remove them from Cuba. Why? Because Cuba is independent of, you know, from the U.S., you know, empire. So does anyone think that if Iran sits down at the negotiating table with the United States and Europeans, that they will just remove the sanctions? They'll never do that. So Iran has to have cards to play with to say, okay, you want us to get rid of this enriched uranium at 60%? Allow us to use the international financial system to import medicine, to import supplies for medical factories, for medicine factories, to import wheat. We can't do that right now. They know why we do uranium at 60%. They all know. But they pretend that Iran is trying to make a nuclear weapon. So they want Iran to give up enriched uranium at 60%. Now Trump said you can't even have it, which is, Iran legally can have enriched uranium at 99%. There's nothing against it in the International Atomic Energy Agency regulations or the NPT. It just should not and cannot be diverted for military purposes. So 60% is within Iran's rights. And Iran can do it 99%. It's their right. But Iran does it at 60% to force Americans to eat the strangulation of innocent people, something which the Americans and Europeans don't want to do. And if someone, thinks, wow, the United States can't be that brutal, just look at Gaza. They're far more brutal than you think.
Well, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough. I know how late it is there and also how much is happening. And you and everyone there are in my thoughts. Well, all the people I like. No, everyone there is in my thoughts. A lot of people are just saying, let's see, all hail Dr. Mirandi. Dude has some more masterful grasp on English as well as much more knowledge than all of Congress. Our country is embarrassing. Professor Mirandi, your unwavering commitment resonates globally. You inspire countless individuals striving for dignity and justice in an unjust world. Let's see. I'm just seeing. This is a nice one from Danny Haifeng. Everyone should support Katie. And I want to give Danny a shout out because Danny helped us with the Zoom because he is a huge fan of our guest tonight. And so he also does Zooms with him. One question. Oh, my favorite Beatle is Mohammed Mirandi. That's good. Did Pakistan offer to help and Iran decline? If yes, why? Do you know the answer to that?
Did Pakistan offer to help
and Iran decline? And if so, why? Yeah.
How was the help in what way and to what?
I don't even know. So not sure, honestly.
I don't know okay. What they mean. One of the differences between now and 10, 20 years ago was that the Americans, when they were the hyperpower, they were able to isolate Iran. It was very tough for Iran. During the war, of course, both the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc were behind Saddam Hussein. Iran was isolated. During the era when the United States was the single superpower, the hyperpower, as it was called it, it was very tough for Iran. But the United States, especially after Iraq and Afghanistan, and I think its neoliberal policies and, removing the anti-monopoly laws and that sort of thing, the United States has been going downhill, and countries across the global south have been on the rise. And over recent years, conflict between the U.S. and Russia, you see conflict between the United States and China increasing. You see the United States at odds with many entities. And as a result, you saw the rise of BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which Iran has joined both. So today, Iran has lots of friends. 15 years ago, Iran was very isolated. Its friends were weak. They were afraid to cooperate with Iran. Now Iran is much stronger. Many of these countries are much stronger. And the United States is weaker. So, and after Gaza, the West has really marginalized itself a great deal. They're looked down upon across the world. So Iran is not isolated like it was in the past. And that gives it a lot of room for maneuver. Iran has good relations with Pakistan. It has good relations with all BRICS countries, China, Russia, Central Asian countries. And so it's much more difficult for the United States today to strangulate the Iranian economy than it was a few years ago.
Well, at least there's that. People should remember that message. Thank you so much, Dr. Mirandi. Please come back on the show. We're so grateful to you and your generosity with your time.
Thank you very much for having me. It was an honor and a pleasure.
Thank you so much. The honor is all ours.
Thank you.
Have a great night.
You too.
Easter should be the best day of the year. It's a celebration of the resurrection of hope. Come to Crossroads Church and celebrate an empty tomb and a living hope. Info and service times at crossroads.net.